Today is walls, checkpoints, housing demolitions, barriers, but more importantly, the effects that they have on people's lives. And because there are a lot of really great resources out there on the web that can tell you the stats and the figures, especially because I can't show you the map very well today. Instead, I thought I'm just gonna tell you stories. Stories of the people that are close to me and the people that I have met in the last year, and the ways in which all of these parts of the occupation change their lives in a very drastic way. I hope that works, and I can give you some resources.
This is a little background question.
Sure.
I went to the one about the refugees last night.
And, okay.
All the Palestinians that weren't refugees, where did those refugees come from? What were their, why did some people become refugees and some didn't?
Good question. The refugees, the people who became refugees, are Arab Palestinians who were living in what is now Israel and who either were forced out of their homes or who fled in the middle of especially the 1948 conflict. And so there are about 700,000 Palestinians who either were forced or fled with the intention that, you know, okay, you know, we're under gunfire immediately right now, we need to get out of this situation, completely intending and thinking that, oh, as soon as it dies down, we will come back to our houses. That never happened and that never worked. They weren't allowed to come back into their houses. And so it is those 700,000 refugees from what was Israel proper that have become the now 4.7 million registered refugees.
Well, the West Bank, Palestinians are still there in the West Bank.
Right. Right.
I know they have these roads that crisscross and divide it up.
Exactly. The settlement roads that divided up lots and kind of make it into the Swiss cheese that, mm-hmm. that was on the initial map. Sorry, I can't show it to you today. But yes, and then there are refugee camps. There are quite a few. There is Aida Camp, which is right in East Jerusalem, which is still on the east side of the Green Line. Dehesha Camp, which is in Bethlehem, mm-hmm. which is just right, that's the one you probably heard most about last night. Yeah, and that's just on the back side of the same hill where our school in Bethlehem is. And so a lot of our students at the Bethlehem School are from Dehesha refugee camp. And so.
Well, are some of the refugees in other countries? I mean,
yes.
Heard big camps in Jordan or?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of refugees.
Most people can't move into those countries, can they? And they don't have the freedom there.
It depends on which country they ended up in. In Jordan, I think a lot of the Palestinian refugees were just kind of assimilated or more into Jordanian life. In Lebanon, I believe, they're still largely in refugee camps. Yep, and then there are also other refugees in Syria. And I believe some in Egypt as well. There are also refugees who have spread out all around the world. The countries right around took in refugees for what they thought was going to be a very short period of time and has now ended up being more than 60 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are also, as I said, there's refugees all over the world. There are actually more Christian Palestinians in Latin America than there are in Palestine.
Did many of them come here?
Pardon?
Did many come to the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right around the Detroit area, there is a very large Arab and a very large Palestinian population. And then also in New York, there is an ELCA congregation that used to be Salem Lutheran, and that congregation kind of ended up dying out, and it was reborn as an Arab Palestinian ELCA Lutheran congregation, they decided to keep the name and just add an A, and so it is now Salaam Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so a lot, the predecessor to my immediate boss at Global Mission, who's the desk director for the Middle East, my predecessor, the predecessor to the person who's in it now, right now my boss is Dr. Robert Smith, he's an ELCA pastor. The person before him was Saeed Al-Abouni, and he is a Palestinian from I think around the Nazareth area. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
History there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, first story then. Imagine you are buying your first house, and you go through all the things that you need to do in order to do that. And you're buying an apartment in an apartment building. I've never bought a house. So I ask those of you who have, what are some of the things you do in buying a house to make sure that you have everything in order?
Save.
You save money.
Arrange for financing.
Sign all the papers, arrange for financing. You'll probably run a check to make sure there aren't any liens on it. Make sure that you're buying it legally, that everything is in order. You go and check with the courthouse. You go and check with the state or with the country or whatever.
Have an inspection.
Yeah, so there's lots of things you do before, lots of things that you want to make sure you do. The woman that I probably work almost most closely with, she's the administrative assistant for the ELCJHL Synod offices. When her and her husband and their two children bought their first place, they did all of that. They checked with everyone. They made sure there were not liens. They double-checked and triple-checked. They hired a lawyer to check. Because when you're buying a place in East Jerusalem, you have to make sure you do that. About 5 years after they bought their apartment, they got a notice saying, your apartment isn't legal. You owe us X amount of money. I think it was at least $10,000 US. And that was for each of the 22 apartments in their building. So again, they took it to a lawyer, and they said, okay, we need to figure this out. Together as us 22 families who all bought these apartments, we need to figure this out. Went through it all, and the lawyer said, yep, I'll figure it out. About 5 months ago now, Eklas came into the office, and she has given me the permission to share this story, but didn't want to share it herself on a video and didn't want me to show a picture of her family, but she said I could tell her story. About 5 months ago, they got a notice saying that there was now a housing demolition order on their house in Beit Hanina on all 22 units, which all had Palestinian families, lower-income Palestinian families in them, and that the Israeli government could show up at any point in time, starting 10 days hence, and knock down their building. And that if they wanted to even try and put a stay on it, their 22 families would have to come up with, I think it was $20,000 US each. And that wasn't to fix the problem, that was simply to put it off and to give them the time to try and go to court and to fight this. The kicker of it is, even if they paid this $20,000, even if they tried to, if their house is demolished, they're still responsible for their mortgage. But they don't own the land. The person who built on the land, who sold these families these 22 units, that same week, three different housing complexes that he had built got these same demolition orders. And if these 60-some housing units are demolished, he still owns the land. And he can rebuild and resell. And 60 families still have mortgages for places that don't exist. But that's only one layer of it.
Is he Israeli or Palestinian?
Pardon?
Is he Israeli or
Palestinian? He is Palestinian, but he lives in the States.
This is the owner of the land?
The owner of the land who sold the buildings. But that's kind of a moot point because they went through They went through the Israeli government and they double-checked and triple-checked and quadruple-checked, because that's what you do there. But that's only one layer to it. Another layer to housing demolitions is that, number one, you never know when they're coming. You never know when they're going to show up with a bulldozer, with a crane, with a ball, and when they're going to rip your home down. So there's unexpectedness. Another thing that my dear, dear friend was so incredibly worried about was that they would come and her children would have to witness their parents be humiliated and witness the fact that their parents had no ability to protect them as children. Witness the fact that there was nothing they could do. When they come and show up to your house with the bulldozer or with the crane or whatever, they also don't necessarily give you any time to get anything out. They may give you 5 minutes, they may not. The Israeli soldiers who come with may go in and decide what they think should be saved and throw a few things out, the windows or the doors, before they destroy it. And so instead she asked, can we leave just a few things at your house? Can we leave just a few things so that we don't lose our pictures, lose our photo albums, lose our things like that if and when they do come? So there's the humiliation, there's the loss of safety and security. And then there's just the immense amount of energy that it takes, not knowing if it is ever going to be resolved. And it's been about 5 months now. It's still not resolved. They still don't know what to do. But when I talked to my dear friend just a few days before I came here about the situation again and asked her if I could share the story here, she said, "I still can't sleep at night. I wait every night for them to come. Every day when I go home from work, I wonder if my house is still going to be there."
What's the reason given for this demolition?
Housing demolitions is that you have not properly gotten a building permit. But building permits for Palestinians in East Jerusalem are almost never given. Case in point, the Mount of Olives housing project that the Lutheran World Federation and the ELCA and the ELCJHL has been working on for, I don't know, maybe close to 10 years. Does anyone know the start date of it? It is to be based on the Lutheran World Federation property, which is where I live, and to offer housing for about 80 Palestinian Christian families, because it is extremely expensive to live and to find places to live in Jerusalem. But the problem is, if you have a Jerusalem ID, which we'll get to in a little while, if you have a Jerusalem ID and you move out of Jerusalem, you'll lose your Jerusalem ID and you will never be able to move back to Jerusalem again. They've been working on this for about, I'd say close to 10 years, and they still haven't gotten building permits yet. The illegal Israeli settlement about 150 yards away from us got permits to build, I think, 240 units earlier this year. And they're building, even though it's on occupied land in which you are not allowed by UN regulations to move people into. Housing demolitions also come if a Palestinian family adds a room to an existing house. But when that happens, they don't just come and demolish the room that was added illegally. They come and demolish the entire house, if they come. And yet there was an article in the newspaper last week. Mitch, were you in the room? But I, like, suddenly had this fit last week in our chalet, and I was like, ah! Because there was an article, I think, in CNN online that was about how 2,000... housing units in an illegal settlement in East Jerusalem had been given permission to each add one room to their houses. And it gets down to the quotes from Israeli officials at the end of the article, and one of them says, well, I don't even know why this is newsworthy. Only in this country would someone think that it's newsworthy to say that 2,000 houses can add a room. Why are you even doing a story on this? And I flipped out, so I was like, because all of the Palestinians there living in East Jerusalem can't add a room to their house without getting a housing demolition order. And I made Mitch and the entire cabin around me listen to it, and then I read a bit from Isaiah, a scripture that always just kind of rings out to me of you will build houses and live in them. And the calls for justice in Isaiah that aren't major outside of this world possibility things, but things that you will build houses and live in them, you will plant fields and harvest them. Those simplistic little things. Another part of Akhlas's story is that actually she lives in Jerusalem illegally. Her husband is a Jerusalemite, her children are Jerusalemites, but she comes from Beit Zohor in the West Bank. And something that is also incredibly difficult to get are what are called family reunification permits. And this happens also with the Muslim population of Palestinian Arabs. But I think it probably more comes out to the front in Christian-Palestinian conversations because of the fact that the Christian population is so small. And at only 1.4%, if you have to narrow that pool even smaller to only people who already live in Jerusalem when you are preparing to get married, that makes it very difficult. But if a Jerusalemite marries a West Banker, how do they live together? The idea is that you're supposed to be able to apply for a family reunification permit for the West Banker to be able to come and to get a Jerusalemite ID and to be able to live in Jerusalem. Because if the Jerusalemite moves to the West Bank, they will lose their ability to ever live in Jerusalem again. But Akhlas has been married for, I think, 20 years. She still doesn't have a family reunification permit. At certain points in time, she has had a permit to enter into Jerusalem and to spend the night there. At certain points in time, she hasn't. And so she just kind of walks around and hopes that no one asks to see her permit for being there in Jerusalem. I was in the car just a couple weeks ago when other people were on the phone, and there had been a new wrinkle added to all of this, in that now Palestinians who were looking for family reunification permits were being told that they had to choose. They either had to apply for a permit that would allow them to enter Jerusalem then and drop the family reunification permit, or they could apply for a family reunification permit, but until that came through, they were not allowed to apply for any permits to enter into Jerusalem. So what do you choose to do? And how do you live with your family, and how do you raise your children, and how do you try and give them the things that I think every parent wants to be able to give their children?
So all these people you're talking about are Christians.
As I said, this also happens among Muslim Palestinian families. I think it just it comes more to the fore in the Christian population because the Christian population is so small. And so if you are a Christian, you need to marry a Christian. And if there is a very small population in any of the places, it's just, and also, I mean, you don't always plan and pick who you're going to marry.
You say a small percent of the Christian population lives in Israel or lives in the occupied territory?
Both. There are Christian Palestinians who live in Jerusalem who have Jerusalem IDs. There are Christian Palestinians who are Israeli Arabs who live in Israel and have Israeli passports. And then there are Christian Palestinians who live in the West Bank who would have West Bank IDs. So they're spread out, and it's being able to see one another that is the difficult part. A couple of wall stories.
I'm just wondering, have some of these procedures changed at all when there are different Israeli governments who are more or less conservative or liberal, or are they fairly consistent?
Heidi, would you know better than that? Did you hear the question?
A lot changed in the year 2000. That was when the Second Intifada began, and prior to 2000, family reunification was still a problem, but obtaining permission, work permits for Jerusalem were pretty accessible for Palestinians who lived close to the city. In terms of administrations, Israel has not gone back and forth over the last 20 years or so, just consistently moved to the right. And so things have calmed down since then, but we don't have a leftist Israeli leader to counter that, to show us what the possibility would be under a different sort of law. Mm-hmm.
Heidi has done a lot of work with Christian peacemaker teams and has been over a few times. And she has longer with this than I do. A couple of wall stories. My dear friend and a UCC pastor, Emily Goldthwaite Fries, who worked with as assistant to the director of education for the ELCJHL this past year, did a lot of work with the English language teachers in all of our schools. And the first time she went to our school in Beit Sahur, she met with one of our English teachers whose name is Samir. And Samir has also said that I may share this story, but he did also ask that I not show his picture. The first time she met with Samir, and Samir found out that she lived in Jerusalem, he took out his wallet, and he opened it up, and he took out this battered, really old business card, and he gave it to Emily, and he said, "Can you go to Charbin's and buy me some English language books?" And Emily just kind of looked at him, and she's like, "Well, I can, but tell me more, please." And he said, "I have had this card in my wallet for the past 10 years. And whenever I meet someone who lives in Jerusalem who might be able and might be willing to bring us books if we give them money, I ask them to." She said, "Well, you know, the obvious question we would all ask, why don't you just go to Jerusalem and get them yourself?" And Samir said, "Well, I haven't been able to get permission to enter Jerusalem for the last 10 years. Samir lives in Beit Sahur. He lives probably within about a mile of the wall, and he lives within about 6 or 7 miles of Jerusalem. And he hasn't been able to go for the last 10 years. But he still has this hope, and then he still carries this card around with him. One of our students in Bethlehem is in grade 11. He wants to be a doctor when he finishes Tauchihi and starts to go to university. His family used to own an orchard with about 100 olive trees and mishmish trees, apricot trees. And so there was their house, and then their orchard stretched out from it. When the wall was built for security purposes, Israel said, "Oh, well, we must have a buffer zone." And so instead of building the wall around his family's land, the wall is within stone's throw of his house, and they haven't been to see their trees in about 6 years. Their family's livelihood is gone, and olive trees to the Palestinian people, olive trees, the olive tree is the tree of life for them. It is a symbol of hope. it is thought in Palestinian culture that and tradition that the cross that Jesus was crucified on came from the wood of an olive tree. And when families plant their olive trees as little olive trees, they don't plant them for their own generation. They plant them for their children and their grandchildren because that's when they will start to produce. We have another person who works in our education offices whose family has olive trees that are probably close to 2,000 years old. And they are now underneath a bridge overpass that is a settler road, one of the roads that crisscrosses the West Bank that West Bankers aren't supposed to go on, that have either barbed wire or concrete fence on either sides. And so even though you may only have 50 feet in between one family house and another part of the extended family, in order to try and get to see that person who used to be a very close neighbor, now you have to try and travel miles and miles. For these 2,000-year-old trees that this family owns, they have a couple of times gotten access to go and visit them. Since the overpass was built, but they haven't been able to go and harvest them. And the construction also damaged a lot of them. So that hopefully, inshallah, God willing, as olive trees are incredibly resilient and strong. I think the Palestinian people, that's also part of the reason that they love these trees. Because they give them hope that, okay, you can come back from this. You can still grow and produce. You can still find new strength. But to have your olive trees taken away from you is like having a part of your family disappear. I've also had a chance to walk with the ecumenical accompaniers of the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel, EAPPI. In the States, we call it EAPPI. I've actually had to learn, because it was really funny, I have a Swedish pastor colleague who works with me, and I always thought he was like referring to yuppies. And I was like, who are these yuppies you're referring to? Swedish, when they try and say the acronym instead of us spelling it out. And so EAPPI comes out, yuppie. I've had a chance. The Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel brings about 25 people internationally. It's a program of the World Council of Churches, administered by them, owned by the local churches. In Jerusalem, it's been around for, I think, about 8 years now-ish. And they just passed their 2,000th ecumenical accompanier this year. They have six teams that work in Jerusalem and in other parts of the West Bank that accompany people in their daily life. They can't actually physically do anything, but they go with, they accompany, they monitor, they have phone numbers they can call when gates are not open, and they document human rights violations, and simply are a protective presence is the hope. Number one, that by being with them. Number two, it is also hoped and part of the call of these EAs that when they go home that they tell their stories. And they come for 3 months at a time. I've had a chance to go around with them a few times. And for one of the times, a lot of their job is to go to get up at like 4 in the morning and to be at the checkpoints by 5 for when they open at about 6. For all the people who have permits, who are either trying to get into Jerusalem for the day to work, to get into Jerusalem for the day for school, to get into Jerusalem for the day because they need to go and visit a hospital or see a doctor. all of these things take permits that you have to apply for and hope that you get. I went with to Calandia Checkpoint, which is the major checkpoint between Jerusalem and Ramallah to the north. And one of the kind of notorious checkpoints for never quite sure what you're going to get. And a checkpoint that is very hard to be at as a human being. At Calandia Checkpoint, you come to the checkpoint from the north, you park your car, you get out of your bus, and you walk into kind of this like metal shed. And when you're first walking in, you know, it can seem quite, you know, like fun and chill. There's a guy selling, you know, Arabic coffee. You can grab your rolls. But you soon realize that there's a reason that they set up there, because they know they're going to sell a lot, because people are going to be waiting there for quite a long time. So early in the morning, people queue and line up, and the line can be very long. But the Palestinians know that they have to wait quietly and orderly, and that no matter how long it takes, they can't make a ruckus, because if they do, the checkpoint will simply be shut down and no one will get through. After you wait for maybe an hour, maybe two, you might finally get to, I really can't call them anything other than cattle chutes. At Calandia, there are three or four different lines you can go through, and once you get there, there's a turnstile at the beginning, and then there are metal bars to your right and left, and there's also metal bars across your top. Below you is cement. Once you go through the first turnstile, you can't go back. But the turnstile's only open for about 15 people at a time, and at the end of about 30 feet is another turnstile. And so, once you enter that first turnstile, you are committed to trying to get through that checkpoint, because you can't get back and you can't get forward. You are there until they open that next turnstile and until you get through. There is supposed to always be a humanitarian gate that is open and available for people who cannot walk or cannot stand, people who are going to hospital, and for young children going to school. The United Nations says that the humanitarian gate must always be open and accessible for these people. You never quite know when it's really going to be open, though. One of the mornings that I was there, at 5 a.m. in the morning, I came with the ecumenical accompaniers. I dragged some women of the ELCA who were there on a trip with me, and they were very good about it. Because we were there with an ecumenical accompanier, and they wear a vest at all points in time, so people can know who they are, so if Palestinians need to ask for help, they can. We were there for about an hour, and the humanitarian gate wasn't open any of the time. And a woman came up to Donna, my friend who was the EA, and she took out her permit, which was a permit to go to a doctor's appointment in Jerusalem. And she couldn't stand in the line. She needed to use the humanitarian gate and needed to be able to get to this appointment, and thought she had left plenty early, but was now worried. And Donna tried to get the attention of there's both soldiers and then security forces, outside security, that are there for the protection of the soldiers, is what I've been told. Behind a metal fence with barbed wire, then inside a bulletproof structure with thick bulletproof glass with many monitors. And we realized, all right, we'd been on film this whole time. She tried to get their attention and tried to get one of the guards to talk to her, and it wasn't working. And so she tried one of her phone numbers to report that the humanitarian gate wasn't open. And they said, well, we don't have the people to open it. She's like, what? Okay, explain this to me. And the explanation was that in order to open the humanitarian gate for people who are unable to stand, for small children going to school, and for people going to hospital, they need to have at least, they have to have one Israeli soldier, along with two security forces people for the Israeli soldier to make sure that they are safe. And they said, well, we don't have that those many people. We can't open up the gate. And Donna was nearing the end of her time, and it's ecumenical accompaniers give a lot when they come, and it is very difficult. They are in the midst of it every day and fighting it every day. And so she was very tired and very frustrated. And so she kept at them until finally, just before we left at almost 8 a.m., we'd been there since 5, one Israeli soldier and two security forces came with him, bulletproof vests, at least two guns on each of them, to open the little gate and to stand, guns at the ready, so that these small children, about 6 to 8, so that these people going to the hospital, and so that these elderly people who couldn't stand and go through the gate and therefore hadn't been able to go through for the last 3 hours could walk past them. It's a difficult situation to walk through every day.
Understatement.
And they tell us coming out on visits coming out that we won't really have any idea how much stress we have been carrying as internationals until we've been out for about 2 weeks. I think that's probably the reason that I slept for 15 hours last night. Because for the first time, for the last 2 weeks at Holden, it's been really wonderful to know that there are no machine guns around. I'm not going to see a single gun here for the 2 weeks that I'm here. And every time there's a loud noise, I won't have to stop and differentiate, which sadly I can now do, as to whether or not that timbre was a gunshot or a firework. And this is just me, knowing that I can leave at any point in time, knowing that my blue passport, my blue U.S. passport, allows me to go in and out. I may take some flack. I may and always do get the highest security rating when I fly out because they have told me to my face, because I am blonde, because I am young, because I am traveling alone, and because I work with Palestinians. Therefore, I'm probably gullible and someone has talked me into taking a bomb. But I can leave at any point in time. I can get these outs to let a bit of the stress out of my life. But the people that I leave can't. And it's so much harder for them every day. And so I am passionate and emotional when I talk. And so despite no statistics, I hope that these stories today inspire you to, if you don't know the statistics, to maybe go and learn a little bit more.
What do you see as a future for the situation?
This has been quite a year for the situation. I've been told it's probably about the tensest year since the Second Intifada, since about 2000. For me, it's just been the normal year. but, I mean, with the Arab awakening all around us, with the reconciliation agreement between Hamas and Fatah that will hopefully allow for unified elections in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and with a lot of discussions, there was a resolution put to the United Nations a couple of months ago that wanted that the Palestinians and the Arab countries asked for the United Nations to put out yet another, I don't know if it was would be a censure or a speaking out against the Israeli illegal Israeli settlements in Jerusalem and in other parts of the West Bank. There was one country that voted no. The U.S. Every single other country. This document also had, I think, more than 100 countries had signed it in support of it. And it didn't help the situation. Right, I haven't been on internet recently, but there were hopes of face-to-face talks in France at the end of June, so I'm not quite sure if those are happening because I haven't, I've been at Holden. So that is one of the hopes that the people, when I was leaving, were hoping for, that there might actually still be some face-to-face talks and a possibility of a resolution. If not, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. There has been discussion of the Palestinian Authority going to the United Nations in September and asking the United Nations to simply acknowledge a state of Palestine on pre-1967 borders. And sometimes in the U.S., the way in which it's portrayed in media here, they'll say, you know, unilateral declaration. But unilateral, you know, normally means one. And there are I think, at least 100 countries in the world who are ready to stand by that declaration of a Palestinian state. So I don't think that that's necessarily a fair thing to call it. If that happens, I don't know what the ramifications will be. I don't know what on either the Israeli or the Palestinian side. So despite the fact that I'm in talks with Global Mission right now about extending the length of time that I stay there, there's still also always the possibility that at some point in time it will be necessary for me to leave for at least a bit. I really don't know. I really hope not, and I really hope that they can still...
Are Palestinians considered to be Arabs, or are they different?
Palestinian Arabs, yes. And then Arabs and Israelis are both Semitic people. But yeah, and so it's there's lots of different terms. So you can also have Israeli Arabs, Israeli-Palestinian Arabs who stayed in Israel proper and have Israeli passports. There are also Palestinians, Arab Palestinians who live in Jordan, and so they would have Jordanian passports. But yes, most Palestinians would also be Arabs.
I'm sure the history goes way back, quite the same roots. Back to the Bible, you know, mm-hmm. Ishmael was the first Arab, really. And the Palestinians were people there that were go way back.
Mm-hmm. Well,
in Palestine, you know, they came, I think, from somewhere on the Mediterranean. They think it was so the boat people came down to Gaza and so on.
Well, even in the Old Testament, I think it's in the Old Testament scriptures, in the Hebrew Bible. I loved my Hebrew Bible class at seminary because I loved them talking about the Hebrew Bible as like this great big huge conversation back and forth. And that none of the books stand alone, but they stand in conversation with the others. And that they wouldn't necessarily like fix or change things that they thought be different, but they just kind of like meld the stories together. And so, you know, even within like the story of Noah, there are parts as it goes along, depending on what backgrounds the writers were from, the different accounts of it, priestly, Yahweh, or whatever, that at one point in time it says you gather one male and one female, and at another point in time, just a few verses apart, it says you gather seven sets of each animal, and that they didn't go back. But part of, where I'm getting back to here, sorry, part of something that I think is important to remember about the Hebrew Bible is that Israel was never only populated with Jewish people. There's also no archaeological evidence that Jericho was ever destroyed. That a lot of the conversations in the Hebrew Bible are about whether or not someone who is not of the people of Israel, whether or not someone who is not can have hesed, can be a part of this steadfast love, and be part of the covenant. And that conversation weaves its way so much through the Hebrew Bible. So I think it's important that we remember that whenever we talk about Israel or Jacob or Zion or that the biblical times, in that there was never a time in which there were not other people there living with them.
My question was, were those Arabs or the people from further west, the Mediterranean? I read something about that. The sea people that came down and settled the coast of where Gaza is and spread. And that's the people that the Israelis conquered when they, you know, they came up through the desert and through the Jordan and so on like that.
I don't think I'm a historian enough to be able to speak to that. From what I know of peoples is that we have always, throughout time, been moving from one place to another. And that has never, the idea of immigration and emigration has always been a part of our history and always will be. As to the exact of who came when and how many hundreds or thousands of years ago, I'm not equipped to answer that.
Okay.
But yeah.
A question about, you're talking about, and I'll tell you that my family lived at Tontoon.
Oh, okay, yep.
For 3 months, mm-hmm. And so have some experience with it.
What time? What year?
3 years ago we returned.
Okay.
But one of the things that was, and I want to just check this or not, you talked about the olive, the orchards being
mm-hmm.
on one side and the separation. As I understood it, once people weren't able to access, there's a 3-year rule and it becomes abandoned, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which
mm-hmm.
allows settlers to take that land over.
Yep.
Even though they're not allowed to get to their land, which is just on the other side of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is part of that intention to make an archipelago in some ways
mm-hmm.
of Palestine and locking, land locking.
Yeah, and that's also was the same reason used in 1948 as to why houses could be taken over. From people who had fled or been forced to flee. There was a law put into effect that said, oh, well, they're absent, they're not here, and they've just left, and they've left of their own accord, and we had nothing to do with it. So we can, you know, of course we can use these houses. There aren't people. They've left their claim. And it is the same for lands, as far as I know.
Well, the military will also uproot the trees from the abandoned land and plant them in the settlement.
Yes.
So Palestinians, if the wall came down and Palestinians ever were able to return to their land, their 2,000-year-old trees are gone.
Yeah. And if you drive around, if you drive to settlements, I still remember this from the first time I went, and we had a Palestinian guide and took us to the settlements, and there's lots of roundabouts, a lot of traffic circles. And in lots of these traffic circles and settlements, they will have these huge ancient olive trees, and we're like, where did they come from? They were uprooted from Palestinian lands and placed as decorative trees in the middle of traffic circles in settlements.
Well, it gives the settlements an aura of permanence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
We had talked to one family who were there who had an orchard for generations, and talking to the family about the grandparents, the mother and father, who were in their 80s, just got exhausted and moved left and went to Venezuela or something.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what that means to emigrate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At 80, I think there were 80 and 85 or something like that, and leaving their family
mm-hmm.
and what had been in their life, it, part of their family's
for thousands
life,
for of
thousands
years.
The
land
yeah.
is so important.
Land is so very important. And it's in the scripture that was a part of Vespers last night for those who were there. Is at the same point in time, like I think a lot of scripture is can be, especially the Hebrew Bible, can be difficult for Palestinian Christians. Because it's the same scripture that is used to say that they have no right to the land that has been their family for thousands of years. And so part of our conversation this year has also been to look at, okay, but what was the context of Israel, Zion, and references to that in that book? And how, when we look at it contextually, can it also bring hope to Palestinians? And that it's very important always to look at context as well.
Movie about a village that every day we went out and protested the
Boutros.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to get the
mm-hmm.
wall around so it didn't separate their homes from their
mm-hmm.
trees. And were there more protests like that? Was that
there are many
to be effective or not effective or?
I forget the stats, but they just had stats in some magazine in the last couple of months that they were stats of the long-term effectiveness of different kinds of resistance. And in that, peaceful resistance, nonviolent resistance, was, far and away in the long term proved much better at actually bringing change. I actually got to go to one of the very first showings of Boudreaux. Mm-hmm. And it's out in the States now. I got to see it last fall at one of the very first showings, and we actually had the producers there and some people from Boudreaux, and so we got to have discussion with them afterwards. And Boudreaux is a small town that was close to the Green Line. It's Budrus, I believe. And the wall, for security purposes, was going to be going very far within the Green Line and therefore taking a large swath in all of their land. And both men and women, young and old, went out pretty much every day to peacefully, nonviolently protest in an attempt to get the wall moved. Eventually, I think it took about 3 years. It did work. And there are, I think every Friday, every Saturday, there are also, I think it's very important to say, there are Israeli people who go out, who cross lines, who go where they're not supposed to or not allowed to go, who go and walk with these people and who are a part of this ICAD, the Israeli Committee against Home Demolitions, is also another major Israeli force is the wrong word, but Israeli movement against housing demolitions to get word out there, and all of their tour leaders are either, a lot of them are refuseniks, young Israeli people who refuse to do their military service, which ends them up in jail. There is also Breaking the Silence. Did you have anything to do with Breaking the Silence, which is former Israeli soldiers who take groups to the Hebron area to talk about the injustices that they were a part of, and who have have want to break the silence and want to bring people there. So there are lots of, this isn't something that is, that there are only Palestinian people working for, but there are a lot of Israeli people working for it as well. Unfortunately, there isn't a large amount that is in the government.
Mm-hmm. What this town that they say they moved the wall, they actually had it built and they took it out and moved it over? Was it surveyed for a certain place?
It was surveyed and approved for a certain place, and there were some uprootings of trees and such as that, and but eventually, with just their consistency and of refusing and being present and with a loud enough voice from the outside world and community, they did petition, were able to petition and at least get the wall moved much closer to the green line.
Just this Sunday they began removing the wall from the village of Aline, which had been purchased since 2005. And they have won, I think it was 2007, that the Israeli High Court said, you're right, the wall has to be moved. So now, in 2011,
4 years later!
Yeah. On the other side of the farmland.
It's just going to be a little ways away.
Yeah, and so now the resistance movement is really questioning where they go from here, because this isn't good enough.
Right.
This is great that we can get back to our land, but that wall cannot stay.
Mm-hmm. A 30-foot concrete wall is not a solution. Time is up. It's choir time, if anyone wants to come and sing with choir. Thank you all. If you want to see some awesome Palestinian handicrafts and learn about how they're being used for economic future and stuff, come tomorrow and you can get a first look, because they'll all go to the bookstore after that. Holden has been very kind to say I didn't have to take them all back with me. It'll be tomorrow, I think, at 10:50 in the morning.